This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Hello and welcome to Saber, a production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and today we have a special guest on the show for you, a returning friend of the show, Dr. Julia Skinner.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining us. We're so happy to have you.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's nice to be back.
Yes. Yes. If you have listened to our show, you have heard Dr. Julia Skinner before. Tea time. We did something about tea time. We did food waste. And we did a video together with old-timey apple pie, which was a delight.
Oh, it was.
Very tall.
Yeah.
It was quite tall. I mean, it tasted delicious, but that was my biggest takeaway was this is kind of difficult to eat.
Yeah, it was very, like, very slow eating pie. It had to be.
Yeah, which is fine, Yeah. Mindful eating. It was, you know, the apples, I really feel like, because it incorporates whole apples, and I think that the apples that we were able to source, even the smallest ones, were larger than the intended apple size that we were dealing with.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
But still, delightful.
Mm-hmm. It was delightful. It was. And it's always delightful to have you on here. Would you mind giving kind of a brief rundown, introduction to our listeners who need a refresher, maybe missed those episodes, go check them out if you did. Just about all the amazing things that you've done and who you are.
Yeah. We usually start these interviews with a solid, like, hi, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I am the author of several food books, like you mentioned, and the latest being Our Fermented Lives. I also run a food history and fermentation company called Root, and so I do fermentation classes. I do in-person workshops sometimes. A lot of what I do is online. I do consulting for people who want, like, a food historian to look at, like, you know, their book manuscript or something and be like, does this sound at all, like, accurate? And so that's kind of fun. I do writing coaching. I do a bunch of stuff. But yeah, I am primarily a food historian and a fermentation enthusiast. And yeah, that's me.
Yes. I mean, and obviously, that means you fit right in our wheelhouse of both friends and show.
Yes.
Because we are all about fermentation. We're all about food history. And yes, you wrote a book, and congratulations, because it's amazing. And you sent us copies, and it's so good. I love it so, so much. And as I was reading it, I was like, why are you so cool?
Oh.
You know all of these things.
Yeah, I was saying in classic move right before we started recording, I've just been like taking little snacks out of it, just like, oh, that's so good. Oh, that one's so good. Oh, thank you. Yeah, yeah. So it's been really fun.
Oh, well, thank you.
It has. Can you tell the listeners about the book, why you want to write it, so why fermentation, all of those things?
Yes. So the topic is giant, right? It's the global history of fermentation, which is a food making practice found in every culture, you know, throughout the world and across, you know, thousands of years. So a large topic.
Yeah. not a small undertaking. We probably mention fermentation in every episode that we do, partially because I love screaming about bacteria poop, but also like it's super fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's, you know, as I kind of got into fermenting food, 10, 20 years ago, I started trying to look more into the history of it. And some books mention some of the history, like it's out there, but it wasn't really all in one place. And I kind of wanted to have what is the comprehensive history of this, or as comprehensive as you can get. And so I started diving in and looking, and I initially was going to organize it geographically, and then what I discovered was that there's so much overlap between, obviously, like, we're fermenting cabbages, for example, in a bunch of different places, and so it would be a really boring book if I'm like, and also here we ferment cabbage. People would be like, okay, great, thank you, Julia, I got it. So I ended up organizing it by themes instead, so we could say, like, why are we fermenting the cabbage? Oh, we're preserving the cabbage, we're adding flavor to the cabbage, we're, you know, whatever. And that's how it came about.
Yeah, it's such a amazing world when you start digging into it, because you're taking what is essentially such a simple process that it happens without any human intervention at all. And that's probably how we got so many simultaneous little pop-ups of very similar products around the world. But because you're just talking about microbes eating your food and then excreting some kind of flavor molecules and something that will usually preserve it in some way, like an alcohol or something like that. But out of that extremely simple definition and simplified definition, fermentation can work on food and drinks on all of these levels, both practical and pleasurable. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think as you were saying that, the thing that came to mind is something that I mentioned in the start of the flavor chapter, which is that, you know, our ancestors had taste buds and flavor preferences and things like us. And I think that we kind of sometimes assume that they were just all eating, you know, terrible subsistence food that was flavorless. And like, it's just not true. And I think our fermentation traditions we see around the world are a good example of that. Certainly fermenting adds nutrition to food as well. But there's something like, let's say, West African sour grain porridges. Those, it's not like you need to preserve the dried grains with fermentation. Like, they're dried grains. They're pretty well preserved. But, you know, from a nutritional and from a flavor standpoint, it really adds a lot. And there's examples like that all over the world.
Yeah, that's one of the ones that I think I only personally keyed into recently. So many of these processes are really digging into how to get more nutrients out of those foods that you're trying to prepare. And it's just it's so smart and amazing that people figure this out.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like it'd be very interesting to kind of watch the process of folks trial and erroring, kind of, you know, how long did it take to do this? Like, what kind of ends up having the flavor nutrition balance we like? What ends up, you know, not working for us?
Yeah. I guess kind of along those lines, could you talk a little bit about what fermentation means to you? Because I know that it was kind of a personal journey getting into it.
Yeah. So I, Yeah, I always turn to Sander Katz's definition of the transformative action of microbes when I talk about fermentation itself, but I think we have to consider that transformation as a, you know, a personal transformation and the transformation of our food. You know, for me, making fermented food is very much a, you know, kind of a center of, oh, I mean, I don't know if I would call it like my wellness practice, but my sanity.
Which is part of a wellness practice.
That... Yeah. Being sane feels like a wellness practice. Yeah. So, you know, I start every day before I do anything else, you know, while I'm making my coffee or doing whatever, I will kind of check on all my ferments. And like, I begin every day with them. I constantly, you know, I feel like they're always teaching me, like I'm always learning something both about the process of fermentation and about, you know, I mean, other life things that maybe aren't exactly about fermentation itself. Like, for example, being patient. Like, it's not like any of this happens, you know, right then. It's not like you're putting something in a skillet and having it be done 20 minutes later. Like, you were on somebody else's timeline, and you kind of have to wait for that somebody to decide when they're going to start doing their thing. You know, and so it's been really powerful in that way. You know, and it's also interesting because I started fermenting food when I had, you know, I didn't have a lot of money, but I had like a lot of vegetables in my garden. And so it kind of became this practice in like abundance. And so like when I have like my class that's preserving abundance, and when I talk about that idea, like that's kind of where that comes from, is that like recognizing how much you have and how much these methods help you capture it.
Yeah, and it can be such a connection point too with you know your personal ancestors, or for in terms of family recipes, or just in terms of your human ancestors around the world, because like human history sort of hinges on fermentation. Do you think that there are aspects of that you're just super into that you think that maybe people don't realize?
I mean, I think, you know, I mean, at the most basic level, if we look at evolution, I mean, like, what did we evolve from? We all evolved from microbes. I mean, if you go far back enough, and like, you know, and so it's like, we're not only dealing with like foods that our ancestors made, our human ancestors, but we're also kind of, in a way, collaborating, you know, with these microbial ancestors, and we're kind of working together in that way. And that's, you know, I mean, a huge oversimplification, and any microbiologists listening are probably like, that's not exactly correct, but like, but like, you know, very broad strokes, like when we think about like microbes that we've had a long relationship with, I mean, the reason why our microbiome is so important to us is because we eventually became the host to these microbes, and still are, and kind of help each other out. You know, and I think too, when we think about that sort of ancestry and about, you know, kind of the impact that this can have on somebody in exploring that. I mean, something I talk about in the book is making sowens, which is this fermented oat, like porridge situation. And, you know, it was really interesting because I'd never had it before. I had no idea what it was. I came across it while I was doing research, and I was like, oh, okay, like, let's make that thing. I tasted it and I was like, this is really familiar. Like, I feel like I've been eating this my entire life. Oh. And I hadn't been. Huh. And so it was kind of this like, and I've talked with people, you know, who've had that experience with other, you know, foods that like their ancestors would have eaten, but they hadn't eaten. And so that, you know, that was also kind of something I found very interesting about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same. I mean, that was one of my very favorite things, was when you would be talking about like this connection between like fermentation and just how humans work and humans and microbes, how they work together. And I love that kind of sense of place of like wild fermentations. And there's something that's really fascinating to me about like, you can plan things to a degree, but then you're kind of just like, let's see what happens based on what's around me and what I can find. And I love that. Mm-hmm. I find that so, so interesting.
Yeah, like it decenters us from being like the sole driver of a cooking practice. And since we're very good at centralizing ourselves, so it's kind of refreshing to be like forced out of that position.
Yeah.
It's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
It's like, ooh, let's see what happens.
It's like, yeah, no, yeasts, y'all take the wheel. Like, right.
Yeah. But,
we are ostensibly a food show, but you also talk in the book a lot about other areas of culture that use fermentation. Could you talk about a few of those?
Yes. So, like, in dyeing, for example, indigo dye.
Like dyeing, like cloth,
not
in
like
the process of death. Yeah.
Or, I mean, I was like, there's also fermentation connected with that, but that's different.
Got it.
Yes, cloth dyeing, or, you know, making inks and whatever. I mean, there's a lot of fermentation used to make, say, indigo dye, which has, you know, a really pretty intense and awful history, including here in Georgia, but, you know, is still, you know, is one of the ways that we use fermentation in outside of food. You know, and other things like ink making, even non-fermented inks will often use vinegar as a preservative. When I make oak gall ink, which is, you know, those like wasp galls on oak, like oak branches.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so you can take that and you take like some other, like some iron filings, and you like cook it down. It makes this really beautiful ink, and then you add vinegar to stabilize it or to preserve it. And yeah, so there's a lot of different ways. I mean, the arts and crafts stuff is, you know, one of the things I'm most interested in, because, you know, I do a lot of arts and crafts stuff in my life. But yeah, but, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of like industry applications and, you know, all kinds of, you know, we're kind of at this interesting moment where we are both very like returning to these traditional methods, like the stuff I do, where I just like throw stuff in a jar and kind of see what happens. And it's very like the most low tech. And also at a moment where we have, you know, these like dedicated, you know, biotech companies working on, you know, strains of yeast that will break down this specific thing in this specific way or something.
Of these, right, industrial levels of either, you know, harnessing the power of fermentation to break down pollutants in our environments, or right, to produce products like flavor molecules or medicines, all kinds of things.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time to kind of have both of those in tandem, you know, having such just so many different ways that we can approach fermentation more than, you know, we've had in the past.
Yeah. And it is so new. I forget about that all the time. But right, you know, we didn't have like cell theory until what, the 1830s. And so we didn't understand how any of this worked until like Carlsberg labs and stuff like that started working in it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all rather new. And yeah, it's very interesting because we had an understanding, obviously, that something was happening. And yeah, like the different ways that we describe like the unseen forces that are shaping this, you know, over time. It's not surprising to me that fermentation becomes the source of so many, like, you know, myths, deity myths, like, you know, all these different, you know, stories that kind of connect it with the divine in some way.
We've got more of our conversation with Julia, but first we've got a quick break for a word from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Ready? Okay.
Give me a beach.
Beach.
Give me great food.
Tacos.
Give me adventure.
Hiking.
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise.
Give me some smiles.
Cheese.
Give me more beaches.
Beaches.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsors. And back to the interview. You've been talking a little bit about the ways in which some of this historical research resonates with people and how it's resonated with you. Have there been any pieces that that you can share with us that just really you were like, oh.
I mean, I think that, you know, that Soane's example was a really good, like, that was maybe the most, like, you know, personally kind of profound one. But yeah, I mean, there's something that I came across while doing research for the health chapter was, you know, Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, humoral theory, like all these different traditional healing modalities around the world that, I mean, explicitly bring in food as medicine in a way that we definitely lost sight of for a long time and are starting to maybe think of again. But, you know, but also thinking about individualized medicine, you know, food is medicine, and about how flavor can help us kind of strike balance between things. And, you know, and sour flavor being one of those things, kind of, you know, in Chinese medicine, thinking about, for example, like it being more prominent in the spring, kind of waking your body back up and all of that. So yeah, that was something that I was like, oh, that makes sense. You know, one of the things was, you know, some of the flavor pairings that we have are based, you know, rooted in this. So, you know, vinegar and pork, lemon and fish, like these sorts of things are actually humoral medicine based, and kind of thinking about like, oh, like, of course, like that makes sense because our, you know, all of this informs each other. Like, of course, that would be true. But yeah, it was interesting to like see it borne out.
Oh, yeah, that stuff is so, it's so deeply ingrained in our culture that we mostly don't even think about it or talk about it anymore. But it is so fascinating when you dig in. I think that was one of my favorite weird offshoot episodes where, like, yes, we're ostensibly a food show, but we got to do an episode about humoral medicine. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah, it's so, like, there's so much to dive into with it. Like, as I always, you know, I think when we're growing up and we hear about it, it's like, oh, it's that crazy thing. They use leeches. And it's like, well, yeah, but, like, there's a lot more.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of it does prove out. Maybe not the leeches. But,
not
yeah.
The leeches probably,
not the leeches,
but,
no.
Yeah.
I guess sort of speaking of, do you have any, like, super favorite weird historical sources? Because you do, like as a historian, you get to go into some weird collections and look at some of these original sources. Do you have any favorite ones?
I mean, I really like, I like just going in and, you know, kind of like when you're playing in the kitchen, like, you know, kind of allowing yourself to be surprised and allowing yourself to have, you know, that serendipity. The first collection that I worked with that was a culinary history collection is at the University of Iowa. And if you have any listeners in Iowa who, you know, ever go to the South Murray collection, they'll know what I'm talking about. It's really very cool. Lots of old books and then lots of other things as well. And yeah, it was very, very fun to go in there. And that's, you know, that's where I found the first old cookbook that I ever started working with, you know, years and years and years ago. The one that the tall pie is from.
<It's>
from comes full circle. Always comes
Hence
back to the pie.
Known. Yeah. Tall pie.
Sounds about right.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We do always love finding and reading out. I think that's one of Annie's personal specialties is reading out old timey recipes that are in a version of English that no longer really exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and the format of them too. I mean, it's so interesting to read them and have like try to translate them for modern cooks. That's always kind of an interesting feat.
Yeah, I feel like usually I do really well until I get to the last sentence. For some reason, the last sentence is always where I'm like, what are you talking about?
Well, I feel like the last sentence in a lot of those, like, it's just like all the information is already pretty condensed. And then it's like, it just like is an extra condensed. It's like, okay, now put this over a fire for 5 days and then like, you know, and store it in the usual way. And you're like, what does that mean?
What's the usual way? What kind of fire?
Yeah, like how big is the fire?
Right?
Exactly.
My landlord's going to be mad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't even have a fireplace.
I know.
Right.
Does a Yankee candle count? What's going on?
Well, it was interesting because we joke, you know, we are ostensibly a food show. We are. So many things come up. We see so many trends that come up. Fermentation is always one. But when the story you told that I was like, oh, yeah, was the friendship bread and kind of how you got into fermentation around that. And it because of the pandemic and so many people were doing like sourdough bread, it just made me think about that. But just like all of these examples of things that we might not consider at first that fermentation is involved in, but it is. And then something like that, like I did that in college too. And it was so kind of like, oh, somebody gave this to me. It's like a pet.
Yeah.
I'd be like, okay, we're going to get through this together and then we're all going to enjoy this. That at the end, which I love because I think like you did such a good job of illustrating that point, and which is one we try to make often in the show is like, you're talking about fermentation, but you're talking about so much more. You're talking about friendship bread. Mm-hmm. Like the name is friendship bread. I loved it. I loved it. And kind of related to that, you had a lot in there about, you know, communities and being respectful of communities and fermentation and things like food insecurity and waste, mm-hmm. and how fermentation can play such a huge role in that. Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. So, in a lot of my classes and in my life, and obviously also in this book, I talk a lot about food waste and reducing food waste. Fermentation is a really powerful way to do that because it allows us to change the flavor and texture of whatever various scraps, but it can also be a good jumping off point as well. So one example I often give is using things like herb stems in putting them in vinegar. And then you have, it's like, okay, well, now you have a flavored vinegar, and you didn't throw all that stuff away. You know, and you can take fermented things that you make, and if you like the flavor and don't like the texture, you know, you can put it in a dehydrator and dry it, and, like, then you can still use it in some other way. But yeah, I like using fermentation as a food waste reducing method for a couple ways, or a couple reasons. You know, one, like I just said, the flavor component, and another being that it's really accessible. You know, I'm able to do something like go and teach a class in a community garden, and people with very limited resources, you know, can probably track down a jar and some salt, and you know, we can kind of go from there. You know, it's something that is very nourishing, it's something healthy, and it's something that, you know, especially if we're talking about food insecure areas where people have limited access to fresh food and want to stretch that food. You know, I mean, if you're not giving people, if people don't have the ability to access probiotic food and maybe don't know how to make probiotic food, you know, I mean, I don't want to say, like, probiotic food is a panacea, because nothing is, but it certainly is important for our health and, you know, can be a good way to empower folks. And, you know, and again, it's affordable and, you know, really customizable, really versatile. It's something I think we could handle to tap into more as cooks when we think about being a little gentler on the earth with our practices.
Yeah, and I talk about this a lot on the show. I live by myself. I'm somebody who's very particular about leftovers and waste. Lauren and I just talked about this. Mm-hmm. And so when I was reading your book, it's so helpful because not only does it have like all these cool like historical facts and history, but you have recipes. You have recipes throughout of how to put this into practice that are helpful, accessible, pretty easy. And there were so many ingredients where I was like, I'm trying to find a way to use this up. And you had a recipe in there. And I was like, ah, the tomato paste. This is what I will do with it. Did you try like all of those recipes? Have you tried all of them?
Oh, yeah. No, it's well, and it's interesting because I wrote the bulk of this book. I had gotten the contract before lockdown, but the bulk of this book happened kind of during 2020. And so I'd probably written about half of it by lockdown. I was like, okay, it's time to like start writing and testing the recipes as all of our grocery stores were having shortages and, you know, everything was chaos and, you know. And so it was very interesting because I try to cook in a very, you know, waste reducing way anyways, but I kind of had no choice. There were recipes that I wanted to make that just like, I was like, well, that's not, you know, that's not going to happen. I was going to try to, I can't remember what I was going to make. There was like a fish thing I was going to make and just nowhere had the kind of fish I wanted. So I was like, all right, never mind.
Yep. Not that one.
But you know, and I mean, I don't do a ton of meat fermentation anyways, but, so it was fine. But like, I'm looking at, I like wrote a little list of all of the recipes for easy reference.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, it's, yeah, a lot of these are ones, I mean, that are both, you know, both standard in my kitchen practice. And also, you know, things like the banana vinegar, I mean, is kind of one of my go-to waste reducing things. Cause like I always assume I'm going to eat a lot more bananas than I do. Like every time I buy bananas, I'm like, I'm going to have a banana every day this week. Well, no, you're not, because they're going to be like inedibly mealy after like 3 days, and they're going to be mushy and terrible, and you're not going to want them. Yeah. And so then I make vinegar out of them instead.
Yeah. Oh, that is always the produce thing. I have such a hard time with that. We talk about that on the show sometimes. I think most recently in our pears episode, where I'm like, oh man, I have these really well-intentioned pears sitting in my kitchen. But I'm not going to remember to check them when they're probably going to be ripe, and then they're not going to be good after that. And so,
Yeah. No, and I do with, you know, I also live alone and have, I tend to buy a lot of produce and then I'm like, oh, but it's just me here. Like, what did I do? Yeah, so I do a lot of just like, oh crap, I've got to pickle that like now projects. And so, you know, that way if I like go out of town or whatever, you know, it'll still be fine when I get back.
Yeah, I mean, the pandemic, I joked about it a lot on the show. For me, it's not quite the same, but I did have to get pretty creative. Well, I have this. This is what I have. I can't find anything else. Let's see what I can do. And I do really like that aspect of it. And there's something about reading your book where, I don't know, there was just something powerful about knowing we've been doing that forever. Like, even though it looks slightly different now, we've been doing that forever. And like you having that moment of, you know, with the Soans, is it called? And you're like, oh, I'm connecting to this, even though I don't really have a particular like memory with it. And you say in there, you talk a lot about like fermentation as a community, both within like your body, but within the community. But you also say like you're looking for big conversations with this, if you could expound on that point for a minute.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, fermentation, like we've talked about, touches on so much. You know, I think the food waste is a good place to jump off because it's a reminder of that we, you know, it's not like we've had supermarkets for really most of history, and we've just had a very different relationship to eating. And a lot of the foods that we consider to be kind of staple foods in a lot of our diets were developed based on that. And, you know, like the boxed mac and cheese, canned soup, you know, whatever, whatever, is like a much more recent phenomenon, you know, a modernization of those things. Yeah. And so, you know, I think one of the conversations I enjoy having is about this sort of like the power of using these traditional foods in our, you know, in our kitchens and making them and interacting with them. And, you know, and I was talking about the personal journey of this and how that I've connected so much with so many other parts of my life and interests through doing this. You know, and one thing I think about a lot is community. And so, you know, with community, when we're making a traditional food in a group, which is in a lot of places over time, you know, it still sometimes happens today. You'll have big, like, sauerkraut making parties, kimchi making parties, you know. Sometimes people get together and have, like, home brewing days, like, you know, whatever. But it's like you're making this thing that both brings your community together once during the making, and you get to catch up and all this good stuff, but you're also providing your community food security in the future. And so you're caring for your community in kind of this long-term holistic way that I think is outside of what, you know, just like when we talk about like food and community, and it kind of often becomes like this kind of pithy statement that it's like, oh, like food brings people together. And it's like, okay, well, what does that mean now? Like, how does it bring people together? You know, and I think this book was nice. The community chapter was nice because I got to like dive into that and be like, okay, like, how does it do that? And that, you know, that sort of gathering and that sort of like intergenerational knowledge sharing, you know, something I talk a lot about in there is about the preservation of culinary knowledge, of fermentation knowledge in particular. The, you know, we're talking about techniques that are primarily used throughout history by people who were not considered, you know, valuable enough to record their information. So you would have women servants, enslaved folks, like a lot of people who maybe didn't have access to either literacy or were, you know, considered important enough to write about, a lot of their techniques and everything would be lost. And so, you know, a lot of when I think about community building too, is like, we're the anchor point between the past and future. Like, we get to decide what's coming from the past and staying with us and coming to the future. And so we are at a critical decision point of saying, I want these culinary traditions to survive. Well, it's on me to write down how grandma does this. It's on me to do whatever. Like, I'm the one that gets to pick. So that's kind of a whole soapbox I can go on, but I'll leave it there.
Yeah. Oh, we love a soapbox.
So we have a lot more ground we want to cover in this conversation, but first we have a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
We're back. Thank you, sponsor.
And speaking about these communities, you know, like so much about fermentation is so incredibly specific to the person who's working with it and the place where they're working and the traditions that have been handed down to them. But there are, as we were talking about earlier, so many practices or tropes that endure across cultures. In doing this research, did you find any examples of that that really surprised or fascinated you?
I mean, one thing that I found was very interesting. I'm not sure I would say surprising, but it was, I found it really fascinating, was that a lot of different cultures, you know, like we talked about, or like you just said, rather, our specific fermentation practices, you know, are specific to us in a lot of ways. You know, the way that I'm going to make sauerkraut is probably slightly different than the way you might. And the place where I live might make it taste a little bit different than the place that you live. But yeah, I mean, as far as kind of the cultural significance of things, you know, one thing that I found very interesting as I was doing my research was alcohol and kind of the role that like we assigned alcohol in different cultures as being, you know, something that was like gifted to us from by the gods and was like a gift that gave us like knowledge and inspiration and like all of these things that like make us feel really good, like it does when we have a few drinks. And you know, and it was very, you know, that was interesting because of course, like, you know, I mean, alcohol, like ethanol is intoxicating wherever you are. So like, I guess it makes sense.
Okay. Do you have any, let's say that someone is totally new to this entire conversation and they are similarly inspired, drink responsibly, but similarly inspired. is there like a good ferment for folks to start to experiment with?
I mean, honestly, I think just like, you know, something simple like sauerkraut is a really good kind of starter one. You know, I'll have people ask like, oh, I've never made ferments before. I want to make like vinegar. I may want to make fish sauce or I want to whatever. And like, those are also really easy, but something like sauerkraut is like a one-step process. You kind of just like, you make it, you put it in the jar, you check the jar, you make sure it's, you know, doing its thing. And then you have sauerkraut. And the nice thing about vegetables is like, if it smells like fermented vegetables, like if it smells like sauerkraut, it's sauerkraut. Like you don't have to worry about like, right, oh, is my sauerkraut going to kill me? Like if it's got like red mold or something on it, like, yeah, don't eat that. But like, if it just looks like normal sauerkraut and smells like sauerkraut, like it's, you know, it's very safe and fine.
Yeah. Yeah. do you have a favorite project that you've got going right now?
I'm trying to think. I have about 100 things fermenting right
now. Oh my goodness. And you're not supposed to have favorites, I know. But
I know,
you know.
I know. It's all right. I'm in the other room. Maybe they can't hear me. So there's this interesting thing that one of my friends posted about a month ago that I am trying, which is using sourdough discard as the base of brine to ferment cauliflower. And yeah, so it's like this really nice, like sour, tasty cauliflower. I'm enjoying that. You know, it's the time of year where I make a lot of vinegar. I have a lot of, you know, apples and stuff. And so I tend to make enough cider vinegar to last me for the year, which is a lot of cider vinegar. and I always end up having to buy some around about June because I'll be like, it turns out like all of those gallons of vinegar weren't enough.
Oops. I cooked too much. Thanks. Yeah.
Yep. Too much vinegar.
Do you have like like a white whale of fermentation? Do you have something that you've been like wanting to do and it's never quite gotten right, or that like you haven't wanted to try yet because it just hasn't like come together in the right way?
So I've made like shorter term meat ferments. Like the only meat recipe I have in the book is for a Thai pork sausage that's like a sour sausage that's like fermented like a few days. Like it's not, you know, it's not a very long ferment, but I've never done like a really long aged like salami sort of situation. I've watched other people do that. I've like helped other people make it and then left and not experienced the final product. But like I've never actually made it start to finish. And yeah, I think that would be fun.
Oh yeah. Oh goodness. Now I'm thinking of when
hungry.
We Yeah, right. Oh, and I'm thinking of that interview we got to go do at Holman and Finch, and they talked us a little bit through their house ferment program and everything they do in that cabinet. I was just like, oh no. I guess speaking of the future, what else does the future hold for you? Are there any other projects you've got coming up that you can talk with us about, or just research you're psyched about?
Well, I'm doing, I'm actually working on another book proposal right now, which I can't talk about, but okay. I hope will be nice. I hope that it like comes to fruition and that, yes. You know, the publisher wants it and all, you know, all the good things. Right now I'm writing a lot of articles. I'm really enjoying kind of diving into my newsletter and playing with like different formats and thinking about food and like different angles. I have an interview series in there. As you both know, and having been part of it, where I talk with different folks connected to food in various ways. So I've been doing that. I kind of have these big longer term dreams of like, I would really love to like have kind of Sander Katz style fermentation residencies, but like also with like, you know, creative writing, art sort of like stuff involved too.
Tie it all in, right?
Yeah. I feel like that would be very fun. I don't know. Like, we'll see. Like, I'm just writing and enjoying things right now.
No, that's an amazing. That's an amazing place to be. Absolutely. The book that we've been talking largely about today is again called Our Fermented Lives: A History. Subtitle: How Fermented Foods Have Shaped Cultures and Communities. But where else can people find you?
So on social, I'm at Bookish Julia and Root Kitchens. And if they want to read my newsletter, it's rootkitchens.substack.com.
Heck yeah.
Yes.
Yay.
Yes, do it, listeners. It's such a good book. And if you like this show, you will like this book.
Okay? Yes.
Like everything Julia's about.
It's so nerdy and funny and thoughtful and like, and sweet, and it's just I'm not buttering you up because you're looking at me on a video call. It's really quite enjoyable. So thank you for making this beautiful weird thing.
Yes,
you're welcome.
And thank you for being here. Always a pleasure to have you. I look forward to hopefully meeting in person and maybe trying some fermented foods.
Ooh, yes. Yeah. Yes. It's always a great part of
person,
a...
But it's been a long time.
It has been. Yeah, we definitely are overdue for an in-person meetup. For sure.
And it is always like a lovely, like selfish part of a good Julia visit. I'm just like, oh man, she's going to give us something weird. It's going to be so good.
Your refrigerator is like amazing. Every time I'm like, oh wow.
It's a lot, yeah.
It is. It's a lot going on. Well, thank you again for being here. Listeners, go check Julia out if you haven't already. And you can contact us if you would like. Our email is hello@saberpod.com.
We are also on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and that other one, Twitter, at SaverPod, and we do hope to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way. This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit Pronamel.com.
Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach!
Give me great food.
Tacos!
Give me adventure.
Hiking!
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise!
Give me some smiles.
Cheese!
Give me more beaches.
Beaches!
What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.